KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Professor Leah Shaver of Hofstra Law, author of the draft article, Illuminating Innovation. And this clever title refers to the light bulb. And so we're going to be discussing today the light bulb, particularly Edison's patents and Edison's efforts to create the light bulb and what they mean today. For those people who have listened to the show regularly, we have discussed patent law occasionally and frequently, I should say, on the show with a variety of scholars who've looked at both problems in patent law and the impact of patents. And today we're going to continue that discussion with Leah, focusing on the light bulb and what we can learn from that famous story. Anyone who has taken intellectual property as a course in law school read the incandescent lamp case, an early case in patent law involving actually, ironically, not the actual patent for the Edison light bulb, but a different patent by one of Edison's competitors, Sawyer and Mann, and that particular case involves a number of important concepts in patent law, including the idea of embodiment, and which effectively means the possession of knowledge by the actual inventor. But it also, more broadly, gave us a good sense early on how courts should interpret what patents actually claim, that is, what inventors actually say they are inventing. Today, we're going to take a look at this case, and particularly at Edison's patent, and Leah has done a quasi-history of the story behind the incandescent lamp case, and then brought that issue forward by thinking about how we consider invention, how individuals and entities actually invent, and whether patent law, in fact, comports with how things are actually done. So one of the interesting things that happens in legal scholarship is an effort to draw on historical facts, either famous cases or not so well-known cases or scenarios, to glean what we might learn from them today and how we might apply them, aside from the general interest in history. And today we're going to be doing a bit of that as well. So I'm excited to have Leah on, who again is a professor at Hofstra Law, who is joining us via Skype from her home in Brooklyn. Leah, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you, Dave. This is an incredibly exciting opportunity, and I appreciate the chance to share this research with your audience.
My pleasure. Let's start off with a question I generally ask my authors. Talk a bit more about your background and how you became interested in patents.
Sure. Well, I'm a lawyer and a legal scholar. I teach patent law and intellectual property law at Hofstra. And I'm also an affiliate fellow of the Information Society Project at Yale Law School, where I was first a student and then a resident fellow for several years. And I got wrapped up in a line of research that was happening there at the time under the umbrella of access to knowledge, looking at questions of intellectual property with some attention to questions of distributive justice, right? Because IP, like many areas of law, creates winners and losers. We give out intellectual property protections because we hope that it's going to incentivize innovation and contribute to economic growth. But the way that those protections work is by allowing the owners of those rights to set higher prices for their products than the market would otherwise bear. Those higher prices mean some people are going to be left out. So we have a very fascinating set of difficult normative questions about how much are we willing to sacrifice access in order to promote innovation. But the thing that really brought me to intellectual property law and keeps me fascinated about it is that wrapped up in those normative questions is an entirely another layer of difficult empirical questions, because we don't actually know that it's the case that these intellectual property protections improve innovation and produce economic growth. That is, in my work, I call it the innovation assumption on which patent law is premised. But I think we should really be treating it as an innovation hypothesis, right? It's very important that we find out the truth about this question so that we can make the right judgment calls and set the right public policy.
Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, we've discussed patents on occasion on Hearsay Culture, but I think for those listeners that don't focus in an area or maybe tuning in for the first time, if you would, just give us a quick overview of what a patent actually is. We know it's intellectual property. We know it covers inventions. So why don't you take it from there?
Sure. Well, when you apply for a patent with the Patent Office, you submit an application that essentially has two parts. The first part is what we'll call the written description or the specification, and in that part you describe what it is that you have done in your laboratory or your workshop that you think is new. And you have to describe it in sufficient detail that others would be able to reproduce it, to replicate it, which when you think about it is very similar to what scholars are doing when they publish in scientific journals, right? They describe how they did their experiment, the results that they got, and the idea is to put the knowledge out there in a way that others can also benefit from it. So the second part of a patent application is the claims. And this part is a little bit less straightforward. Maybe, in fact, it's a lot less straightforward. The claims are where your lawyer very carefully and strategically, using precise legalese, crafts the boundary lines around what you hope to claim is your territory, in which others may not intrude and may not imitate the work that you have done. And one of the things that's important to understand about these claims is that every patent application is going to contain multiple claims. And the reason that you put in multiple claims is that you're not sure which of them will ultimately stand up in court. The visual image that I would give to explain this point a little better is that if you imagine in a field the exact precise thing that you have built or achieved in the laboratory, then around that, at some distance away, you're building a fence, right? And you're essentially telling the world, when that patent claim gets approved, I claim all of this space, not only the exact thing that I have produced, but also things that are similar enough to it that they would come inside this fence. And what you're doing as your patent lawyer files your application is that you're actually setting up a series of concentric fences, bigger and bigger and wider ones out. Obviously, you want the most territory that you possibly can, but we have rules in the law that the Patent Office is going to try to apply that say you're only entitled to the size of territory that your contribution justifies. But because those rules are not so straightforward and because they depend on a lot of factual information about what else is happening in that technological field, what other people have done that is not necessarily apparent at the moment that the patent examiner is spending a few hours at a time on your file, we essentially allow patent applicants to stake out all of those fences in their application. Some of them will get knocked down because the patent examiner can say, oh, well, this widest one is clearly not justified. Others of them may also be invalid, but we won't know that they're invalid until the litigation turns out. So one way to think about it is that when you submit a patent, you are describing and disclosing to the world what it is that you've achieved technically. And you are making a vigorous claim to control a set of rights in a technological field that time will tell and are disputable how much of that is what you truly are legally entitled to and how much of that was bluster.
When we think about patents, and we've spent time on the show talking about reform issues, you mentioned and you focus, and we're going to focus on in a moment, the very issue of claims and what claims are. And I think just, again, as a contextual question, claims and describing what it is that you're inventing are not the only barriers, of course, to getting a patent. Can you, and again, recognizing that this one question could easily take the rest of the interview, with regard to the other factors, very quickly, how do they fit into this issue of thinking about the claims themselves?
Sure. Well, in order to qualify for a patent, the invention also has to be, the most important requirements are that it's new, and newness has a couple different meanings in the law, right? Lawyers will talk about novelty as meaning, has anybody else ever done before the exact thing that you claimed? And another dimension of newness is what the lawyers will call non-obviousness, which is that maybe somebody else hasn't done this exact thing, but there are other things that come so close that we're going to say what you have done here that you're trying to claim a patent for should not really be so much considered an invention, but is simply ordinary engineering work. Those requirements of newness are foundational to our cultural understanding of what an invention is, and they're also foundational to the legal understanding of what deserves a patent. But they're tricky to work out in practice. The way that they intersect with the claims is that, like I said, you're going to throw out all these fences there, and then you're going to go out to perhaps other people in the field who are producing technology that you think is inside one of your fences, and you're going to say, look, here's my patent. Read this claim language. See what you're doing infringes my patent. And they may agree and say, I'm sorry, we weren't aware of your patent. Let's negotiate how to resolve this, which might involve payment of licensing. Or they might say, we don't believe that what we're doing is actually inside your fence, or we don't believe that that fence would stand up to legal scrutiny, and here's why. Often what will happen if the two parties can't see eye to eye on those issues is that you'll have some litigation. And in that litigation, the party that's accused of infringement gets a chance to challenge the validity of these claims, these fences. And very often, one or more of those will be struck down as having gone too far in trying to claim material that either wasn't truly original and new, and therefore shouldn't have been the property of the patent holder, or that claimed more than could be justified in light of what that patent holder disclosed and taught in the descriptive portion of their patent.
We're chatting with Professor Leah Shaver of Hofstra Law, author of the article forthcoming that is not yet placed for any law review editors who are listening to the show, Illuminating Innovation. Leah, let's get into the article. And I mentioned in the introduction that the incandescent lamp case is one of those foundational cases in IP law. Describe the case for the listeners and its relevance to patent law today.
Sure. Well, maybe a bit of background, since I know not all of the listeners went to American law schools. Mm-hmm. One of the big things that we do in U.S. legal education is that we study excerpts of many, many different cases relative to our subject. So patent law casebook, if you're taking a U.S. patent law course, might have 600 to 1,000 pages and brief excerpts from a number of notable cases that help to illustrate different principles of patent law that are still good law today. One of these classic opinions that tends to be excerpted is that of the incandescent lamp patent. And this is a case that the U.S. Supreme Court decided in 1895. The full name of the case is Consolidated Electric Company versus McKeesport Electric Company. And in it, it is the culmination of a longer patent battle. And in this episode of it, Thomas Edison's company was accused of infringing a patent held by another electric company, which had been obtained by some competing inventors who were rivals of Edison at the time that both were working to perfect and commercialize the incandescent light bulb. This patent had very, very broad claim language. It's one of the fences that it threw out there was that it claimed control over any light bulb that used an incandescent filament made of carbonized vegetable matter. And that's significant because at the time that that the holders of this patent, their names are William Sawyer and Alban Mann, at the time that they were doing that work and obtained that patent, they were working on this line. They believed that the carbonized vegetable matter was going to be a better alternative to mineral carbon, which was widely being used. And at that time, Thomas Edison was working in a different track. He was trying to perfect a light bulb that had a platinum filament. This turned out to be a complete dead end for Thomas Edison, and he eventually realized that the solution did lie in the realm of carbonized vegetable matter, and he set about the search for which vegetable matter would be the best and work most efficiently. And he tells that famous story, which is probably apocryphal, of taking a thread from his wife's sewing basket and carbonizing, and that was supposedly the secret that made the invention work.
I was going to say, so yeah, because that leads us, I think, into the core of the case. So go ahead.
Great. So if you take this claim literally, Thomas Edison's work is absolutely infringing it, and his light bulbs are illegal because they did contain carbonized vegetable matter. So what Edison's lawyers had to claim in court was that this claim was invalid, that this fence should be struck down, that Sawyer and Mann were actually not entitled to such broad control over light bulb technology. And the Supreme Court does, in fact, deliver an opinion exactly to that effect. So the case is studied today as an illustration of a doctrinal rule that's still good law today about claim scope and enablement. But what I found very interesting in studying the case is that I think the legal reasoning was really secondary to the background dynamics and the politics of what was going on, right? This is not an isolated case, and it's not an isolated patent. There were more than 100 patents held by many different inventors and ultimately many different companies that related to incandescent light bulb technology. Thomas Edison had obtained a lot of those, and that put his company in a very good position when it came time to manufacture these light bulbs. There was, for a long time, a very competitive field. Many different companies were manufacturing light bulbs, and the property rights were very unclear. And if one company said, "We think you're infringing on our light bulb patents," the other company might say to it, "Well, we have some patents that we think you're also infringing. So do you really want to take us to court?" So, for a while, we had this free-for-all where these different companies were competing in the market, and then the litigation began. And this litigation takes place over a span of more than 10 years. A lot of it takes place on the European continent. And this 1895 case that seems like the decisive factor, and really is, it is the final battle between Thomas Edison and this other company, is simply the last battle in a long series of legal skirmishes, the result of which was to run one company after another into either bankruptcy or consolidation with the winning company. So this is this case should be understood as the capstone to a long legal campaign in which Thomas Edison consolidated control of the U.S. light bulb industry.
When we're thinking about the light bulb itself, it's a situation where people can, in fact, even if you're not a patent lawyer, relate to the bulb itself. But, you know, more specifically, when we think about the light bulb, you know, we're thinking about a threshold, fundamental, life-changing invention. And at the core of your article is the question, and I think it's a top-level, somewhat theoretical question, but we can dig down more deeply, is the question of whether Edison or anyone else would have invented the light bulb in the absence of patents. And that's where the story, I think, gets very interesting, and I think that we want to talk about here. If Edison had not had the right to go to the patent office and get a patent, this limited monopoly on the invention, Do you think Edison would have invented the light bulb anyway?
Well, Edison said at one point, no fool but a blockhead ever invented except for money. So he definitely was making a very public statement that the economic incentives were essential to him, right? He didn't just invent because it was fun and he loved the science of it. He was trying to get rich. He was an entrepreneur, first and foremost. And he chose, at a certain point in his career, to focus on the electric light bulb as his next big project, in part because he realized, as did many other people at the time, of the tremendous economic potential that lay in this particular technology, right? So at the time that Edison and others are beginning serious work on, I mean, well-funded work, right? Not just the academic experiments that had a 70-year history before that. At the time that serious work on making a commercially viable light bulb begins, gas illumination, piping gas to people's homes for light, is already a huge business, very lucrative. And we have electric street lighting, right? Not using light bulbs, but using a different and harsher form of electric light. So it was clear to a lot of people that if you could just solve this problem, right, and figure out how to bring electric lighting technology indoors in a way that would be safe and cost-effective, that there was a lot of money to be made in it. And that prompted investment in Edison, and that prompted investment in competing inventors as well. In fact, at the time that Edison is working, there's almost sort of an air of inevitability by that point, right, that that people at the time believed that a working light bulb was just around the corner, and that the question was whether Edison would get there first or somebody else. So that was the perception at the time, right? And the companies were trying to pick the winner so that they would come out on the top and their investment would be realized. Now, the patents were hugely important to Edison's fundraising strategy to secure the investment for his research and development. His contracts with his investors, it's important to say at this point, the context that in addition to being an inventor and an entrepreneur, and I'll argue also a litigator, right, another dimension to Edison's personality is that he's a hustler, right? And he can sell a business proposition. And before he goes to people to ask them for money to fund his light bulb research, he calls a press conference and says that he has it, that he has solved the problem, and gives the public perception that he already has this working light bulb, and that as soon as it's protected by a patent, he will disclose the details to the world. And that was utter hogwash. That was simply a brash claim by Edison to make himself look like he was going to be the winner, right, and instill investor confidence. And his investors, I think, knew or at least suspected that he didn't really have the solution, but they were placing faith in his technical abilities and his evident determination in hopes that he would arrive there. And the contract between them, where they give funds that Edison ultimately uses to fund this very expensive research endeavor that continues for several years, the contract doesn't commit Edison to deliver a working light bulb, much less a working light bulb of a certain efficiency or certain market acceptance or anything like that, right? The contract is a form of best efforts promise, where Edison says that he will work on this project and that he will assign his patents, that the investors will have a share of ownership in his patents, right? So the only thing of value that these investors were promised at the end of the day was that they could count on coming out of this with some Thomas Edison patents in the area of light bulb technology. And that itself seemed like a pretty promising deal, right? Even if Edison didn't win the race to be the first to have a commercially viable light bulb, or didn't win the competition in the market to be considered by consumers the best source, at the very least, it was a safe bet that he was going to have a number of relevant patents in the field that could be used to negotiate and extract payments from anybody who is making money in that technology. So I think the answer to the question that you originally asked of would the light bulb exist without Thomas Edison's efforts? Did we need the patent incentive system to motivate Edison to do what he did? Is a complex one, right? It probably was a matter of time before we had a commercially viable light bulb, right? The money that was on the table to be claimed was great. And there were other technological advances quite out of the control of Edison and others working on the light bulb. Advances in vacuum technology, advances in electrical generation technology that had made this sort of the ripe moment for the light bulb to become a reality. But maybe without Edison's efforts, or maybe without the incentives of the patent, it might have been 5 years later that came to market. It's hard to tell. And of course, a tempting or troubling alternative question is maybe without patent protection, we would have had that light bulb sooner, right? So one of the things that's going on here, one of the ways that you can see patent protection impacting this race over the light bulb is that Thomas Edison spends more than the first year of his research trying to go down this dead-end path of the platinum filament. And historians and biographers of Edison have never really explained why he did that, right? Why he seemed to be so stubborn when people were telling him that the more promising field lay in using carbon. But for me as a patent lawyer, there's this alternative explanation that immediately leaps to mind, which is that other people had already filed patents in the area of carbonized material. Edison knew that if he could really strike out in a very different direction, if he could solve the problem in a way that nobody else had tried to, he would be writing on a blank slate, and his patents wouldn't have to compete with patents already filed by other people. So there was an incentive that patent law created for Thomas Edison to work on this ultimately unpromising and ultimately unsuccessful line of research. And, you know, it is fair to wonder if these barriers hadn't existed and if the researchers could choose their technological research path based solely on technological merits and not based on legal merits, maybe the problem would have been solved sooner, right? So that's what I'm talking about, is this fundamental empirical mystery at the heart of patent law, which is that there are good reasons to believe that patents speed up innovation and good reasons to believe that patents slow down innovation. And we simply don't know enough about enough real-world examples yet to be confident that one or the other of those dynamics is stronger.
We're chatting with Professor Leah Shaver of Hofstra Law on KZSU FM Stamford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it is on KZSU FM, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to the show. So Lee, at the end of that last answer there, you started getting into, I think, what, you know, for lack of a better word, is the thesis of your article. And you used the phrase the innovation hypothesis, which I think ties directly into what you were just saying. But for clarity and to get at the contribution I think you're making with this article, what is the innovation hypothesis?
Sure. Well, as I define it, we have this presumption underlying patent law that the more property protection we give and the stronger we make that property protection, the more we incentivize innovation, right? We're creating rewards for innovators, and the bigger we make those rewards, the theory goes, the more innovation we'll have. It makes intuitive sense. It makes common sense. And it is the assumption on which patent law is founded. But what I argue is that we really need to treat this more scientifically, right? Patent law is too important to the economy to allow it to continue to go on an unproven assumption, right? We need to treat this as a scientific hypothesis, and we need to gather evidence that is going to help us to prove or disprove this hypothesis that patents promote innovation. And so my case study around Edison and the light bulb is one attempt to do that, right? I certainly don't think that it is going to yield definitive answers or end the debate in any way. I think it is simply a contribution. And one of the reasons that I think that it's so important to look to history for these answers is that there may be short-term and long-term impacts of patent law and innovation that differ, right? So, for example, in Edison's case, we can see in the short term some pretty clear benefits of patent protection, right? Because he had patents that he could promise his investors, he was able to get money from them, and he was able to fundraise for what he needed to do his research and development. The incentive effect of patents is very clear in the immediate term, right? But the downsides of patent protection, the ways in which patent protection may hold back innovation, might be only fully apparent over the longer term, right? Certainly, I think that's the case with the early electric industry, that in the early term, we had everybody excited about this technology and the money that was available to be made. A lot of money poured into it and success, right? We have this new technology that reaches the market and is beginning to be used, and a lot of companies are making money. But what happens next is that the lawyers get involved, right? And each of these companies is evaluating its options for expanding its market share. And those options include making an even better second generation product so that people prefer your product to your competitor's product. Of course, if you're playing that game, you have to continually race and race and race to stay ahead of your competition, right? It's good for consumers, but you can imagine why it wouldn't be the most attractive option on the side of the company that actually has to do the continuous innovating. Another option is to compete on price, right? To sell your light bulb cheaper than the other company's light bulb. Again, that has obvious drawbacks from the company's perspective. And a third option for expanding your market share is to take some patents to court and to single out one of your competitors that you think you can prevail against in court and obtain an injunction against them that basically says they have to stop making the product that they're making. That is an anti-competitive use of patent law, but it's not illegal. And what we see in the history of the early electrical industry is that this is precisely what happens. And it doesn't happen right at the beginning of the industry. It happens as the industry matures, right? And as these companies have proven the economic potential of this technology, and there's now a lot of money to be had there, and as these companies have enough sales and enough revenue stream that they have the luxury of spending a significant portion of those funds on litigation, right? And in the paper, I analogize this to the board game Risk. Have you ever played it?
I have.
Okay, so maybe you could describe it real quickly.
Yeah, so the concept of Risk is a game where you are trying to take over the world by putting values on given plots of land, countries, and attempting to outsmart your opponent.
Right, so it's a game of strategy, mm-hmm. and the end goal is world domination. And this actually seems to me to be a pretty good metaphor for what the litigation looked like in the early electronic industry, early electrical industry, right? What you do first, if you're a strategic player of the game Risk, or if you're a strategic litigant, is that you figure out which of your several opponents is the weakest, right? Which has the fewest Resources, which has the fewest patents in its own portfolio that it could threaten you back with, and which is most strapped for cash and therefore might not be able to mount as vigorous a legal defense as they would like to. And you target that opponent. You take them to court. You throw everything you have at them. And if you win, then it's checkmate. They're over. They have to go into bankruptcy, or maybe they can work out a settlement with you. And then their patents become part of your portfolio. You've actually gained strength. And even if you lose, you get another bite at the apple, right? Because you can initiate litigation on any one of a number of different patents that pertain to a particular technology. There is no single light bulb patent, just as there is no single smartphone patent. There are dozens or hundreds, maybe even thousands of patents relevant to a particular technology. And there's a good bet that somewhere in there you can find the right weapon to use against a competitor. Risk end game is that slowly, the strongest, most clever party achieves the goal, right? Which is to run all the competition out of business. And then they not only have the whole market share, but they can stop worrying about competing on continuous innovation, stop worrying about competing on price, and sit back and relax and collect the rewards that come with dominating a market. And that's where General Electric, which was the successor company to Edison's company, found itself at the end of the 1895 incandescent lamp patent case. That their only serious competitor that they couldn't run out of business agreed to a truce, right? They would take England, Edison could control the U.S. market. Every other company that manufactured light bulbs had to cut a deal with Edison's company, and Edison's company set the prices. That ultimately led to an antitrust investigation for anti-competitive practices. But by then it's too late, right? It's very difficult to undo that kind of market dominance once it's achieved.
We're chatting with Professor Leah Shaver of Hofstra Law, and I should note we're recording the show on May 18th. We're airing next week. Leah, getting into this, and I think it's a really interesting aspect of the history of Edison, and I should say that we're at the unfair portion of the show, which is the time in the show when we're short on time, and I start asking questions that you might want more time to answer. So your time, your time is dwindling. But hopefully I can ask these questions in a more tailored way. One of the interesting things you point out in the article is, and you alluded to it earlier, is almost this element of bravado behind Edison, but more specifically, this use of publicity of public statements with regard to one's work. One's inventive process or the outcome or expected outcomes of research that Edison used quite interestingly and quite effectively. And you've talked about it a bit, but you say in the article, and this is quoting, you say, "The myth of invention may not have been fashioned by reporters to make sense of complex phenomena of technological change as previously believed. Rather, Edison's case suggests that this narrative, the narrative that he told and that you alluded to earlier, was deliberately planted in the media by patent holders in anticipation of future patent disputes," which I find fascinating. So perhaps you could talk for a few minutes about the role of publicity in the inventive process.
Sure. I think there is a strong misconception in popular culture, or at least the way that I grew up believing invention happened, that we tend to associate the name of a single person, right, as these great inventors, these fathers of a certain technology, right? Alexander Bell invented the telephone. Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. These sorts of stories. And the reality is much, much more complex. Intel had a great commercial back in 2009, where they have this sort of rock star music playing, and this middle-aged engineer walks through the corridors of a technology company, and everybody just sort of oohs and ahs over the celebrity. And the punchline is, our rock stars aren't like your rock stars. But then the rock star here is identified as the co-inventor of the USB drive, right? And that's actually a really honest picture of the way that invention happens. When you're talking about any sort of complex technology, no single person pulls it off by themselves, right? There's a field of people that contribute to these achievements and whose contributions need to be taken together to make the technology work, right? So in theory, patent law accords different patents to different people within a single technology, such as the light bulb or the smartphone, according to the specific contribution they made. But if you're thinking down the line to eventually playing this risk game of litigation, what you want to do is to set yourself up so that you create the perception that your contributions were bigger than everybody else's, right? Maybe that your contributions were entirely the game, and other people's contributions deserve to be discounted entirely. Because to the extent that you succeed in that, then you're making an argument that the law should recognize your property rights over that technology as being broader and should discount the claims of others who contributed to it, right? And that is, I think, an end game that Thomas Edison had in mind from the moment that he started work on the light bulb. And recall that this is an experienced high technology entrepreneur. This is not his first time in the patenting game. He's no stranger to patent litigation whatsoever. So from the beginning, it seems that it's almost as important to Thomas Edison to create the public perception that he is the inventor of the light bulb as it is to actually achieve that technologically, right? Hence, you know, all these press conferences, and I have to give a shout out here because I'm really standing on the shoulders of a wonderful communication scholar, Charles Bazerman, who wrote the book on this topic of how Edison staked his claim in the media to be the inventor of the light bulb. But what eventually happens down the road as the litigation plays itself out and as the companies consolidate is that the courts end up being forced to decide who control over technology should go to. And that's not something that courts are trying to decide, but that it's something that the litigants want. They don't just want a particular patent for their particular contribution. They'd like to control a technology and therefore the market for it. So this dynamic of using public relations strategy essentially to influence litigation outcomes is one that I see happening around the light bulb, and it's a dynamic that I think may still be at play today in some ways that we don't appreciate. Go ahead.
And well, that is the perfect follow up question, Leah. as we think about what and it's a fascinating history what this story means today. So go on and you can go ahead and answer the question you just asked yourself.
Well, one of the most interesting parallels that I see today with what I found and what I was surprised to find in the light bulb case study is that this dynamic of patent warfare that Thomas Edison was engaged in and the whole battle for domination in the courts is not confined to that technology, right? We have right now what a number of people are describing as a patent war in the smartphone industry. And there's some interesting parallels that I'm interested to explore further in a future work, right? A lot of these early cases are being filed and decided in Germany, which was also Edison's strategy. That might have to do with the fact that German courts are a little bit more injunction happy than American courts. They can favor the plaintiff. They are less concerned to decide questions of patent validity right off the bat. But I see that we seem to be in the opening salvos right now of a new patent war. There are a lot of, if you are looking at what's happening right now in the smartphone industry, it looks a lot like what was happening in the light bulb industry in about 1885. And of course, the outcome in that 19th century patent war was that 10 years down the road, you no longer had a competitive market, but you had one company controlling things. Right today, we take for granted that we are going to make a decision between getting an iPhone or a Samsung or an LG, or that we have all these options. And of course, we expect that 3 years from now, the options will be much better than they are today. But I think that we can't take that for granted, right? If this patent war goes the same direction as the patent war over the light bulb, the end result may be that we only have one company controlling the market for smartphones, and innovation might slow down a lot.
We're chatting with Professor Leah Shaver of Hofstra Law School on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, the issue ultimately that you're talking about here, Leah, and here's a really unfair question, so I'm going to limit you to 3 minutes on this, is one of this balance of incentives versus monopoly rights. And this is obviously a topic that's been raging for several years, arguably culminating in the American Invents Act, the patent reforms that occurred late last year. But I'll ask you, I mean, in terms of where patent law stands today, if you're going to tell policymakers you need to read the incandescent lamp case, you need to know the story of Edison, what is the primary lesson that you want policymakers to learn from this story?
That we shouldn't put so much faith in patent law to allocate rights in the market and to incentivize innovation. Patent law sounds neat in theory, right? That common sense idea that if you put out big rewards, you'll incentivize more effort. But when you look at the way that it really works on the ground, what you are seeing is a messy system, a subjective system, a system that is gamed and manipulated, and a system that is being used to consolidate markets that otherwise would have been more competitive. And that's something that we should be very concerned about. You know, I'm early in my career, and I'm still assembling evidence, right, to decide what I ultimately think the right solutions are. But we just can't be so sanguine about patent protection is great and gung-ho and everybody benefits. There are deeply concerning dynamics at play here.
The again, in the few minutes that we have, I'm not asking this as a for a thorough response, but as you know, economists like David K. Levine, which again, listeners will wonder, is no relation and not me, Emma Kelly Boldrin wrote a book a few years ago called Against Intellectual Monopoly, where from an economic standpoint, they argued that both patents and copyrights were unnecessary. Jim Besson and Mike Moore have written a similar book from a legal perspective, not quite going as far as Levine and Boldrin, but certainly questioning the need for a lot of the law that we have in this field. Again, recognizing what amounts to a 2-minute answer, what's your top level view of their work?
Well, so I definitely view them as fellow travelers. We're all interested in the same question of, do patents really work? And my answer to that is that I think the jury's still out. I think that we need more evidence, and that it should be a priority for patent scholars to figure out where we can get that right evidence. This is too important to get wrong. We just have to figure out what the truth is and then confront policy honestly.
One of the challenges in IP has been this lack of empirical evidence, and that's starting to change a little bit. I at least my sense is that more IP scholars are doing empirical work. But I'm curious to get, you know, any hypotheses you have on why it is that we don't have empirical data, even though obviously we're talking about patents and copyright, for example, going back to the Constitution. Why do you think it is that we don't have the empirical data necessary to not only analyze a situation like this, but, you know, analyze very high profile issues like copyright piracy, where we lack data on the basic question of whether, in fact, the entertainment industry is actually losing money based upon piracy, and if so, how much?
I think one of the challenges is that this is an empirical question that really bridges disciplines and needs expertise and input from multiple sides, right? It is difficult for the economists to structure the studies correctly and get decisive answers if they don't have a legal scholar's detailed understanding of how the law really works. Then, on the other hand, legal scholars trying to answer that question don't have the same benefit of the methodological grounding of the economists. I think this is really a challenge that requires team playing, right? If we're going to solve this puzzle, if we're going to test the innovation hypothesis and find out the right answer, it's going to require input from people across a number of different disciplines figuring out how to work together to crowdsource that answer.
Professor Leah Shaver of Hofstra Law, I'll ask you, Leah, in the remaining minute or two that we have, and I asked this question of prolific scholars, what are you working on now other than this article, which again I emphasize is on the Social Science Research Network, the SSRN webpage, but is also in progress. What else do you have on the table at the moment?
Right, so the next step in this research project, I'm doing a piece that looks more specifically at this parallel with the smartphone patent war, and trying to build out, you know, how concerned should we be that this might go the same direction as the light bulb patent war, and what could be practical solutions to avert that outcome.
Well, it's a great topic. In fact, for next week's show, I'm going to be chatting with Christopher Segoyan and Stephanie Pell, co-authors of an article on how we can set standards for law enforcement entities that want location data from your smartphone. So I invite you back in the future once you have something you'd want to discuss on air to talk about those issues. Meanwhile, Professor Leah Shaver of Hofstra Law, author of the draft article Illuminating Innovation, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. It's been a great discussion. I look forward to chatting with you in the future.
Thanks so much, Dave. I'd love to take you up on that invitation.
I'm excited to mention several guests that are upcoming on Hearsay Culture for the remaining shows that we have this semester, or this quarter, I should say. As I just mentioned, Christopher Segoy and Stephanie K. Pell, co-authors of the article Can You See Me Now? Towards Reasonable Standards for Law Enforcement Access to Location Data that Congress Can Enact. Baron Zilka of Tech Freedom, co-editor of the book The Next Digital Decade, and Marvin Amori, author of First Amendment Architecture. I also have a number of guests coming up down the road, including Professor Brett Frischman of Cardozo Law, author of Infrastructure, the Social Value of Shared Resources. Return guest Professor Julie Cohen of Georgetown Law, author of the book Configuring the Network Self. Andrew Renz, research associate at the Center for the Study of Public Domain at Duke. And others. I'm in the process actually over the next few weeks of booking guests for the summer quarter, which is going to begin in July after the several-week hiatus that Hearsay Culture will be on in June. For those of you that are interested in listening to the show other than live on air on KZSU, you can listen via podcast by going to either hearsayculture.com or by going to the Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu or by going to CIS's iTunes page where you can not only get this show but all other events going on at CIS. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned for more diverse programming and have a great day.